You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
We would certainly want to work toward a world in which people are not living in abject poverty, as about half the world's population is. We would certainly try to fashion a world in which the ability of a nation state to amass military power wouldn't be the basis for the privileges of some and the suffering of others. I mean, all of these things are pretty straightforward. We just have to take our own moral principles seriously.
That's the voice of Dr. Robert Jensen. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Jensen about the naturalization of violence against women through media, the role of pornography in compounding the impact of race and gender discrimination, and reinforcing patriarchy and capitalism. So stay tuned.
When we think about the way displacement has caused those disadvantaged in society by economic structures, by gender, by racism, by sexism, I'd like to focus primarily on those who are deeply impacted in any society. And I think women seem to be at the bottom of that scale. Someone who has written extensively on the way the state is implicated in perpetuating hierarchies and structures of oppression is my next guest, Dr. Robert Jensen. He's a very well-accomplished author, but one of the areas that I really am excited you write about is the area of feminism. And in your book, Get Enough, you touch on some of these issues. Thank you so much for joining us and for being with us this morning.
Great to be with you, Sylvia.
Now, when you read your book, you immediately are presented with a world that most of us dare not discuss, you know, the world of pornography. And you make the connection how pornography has not only become a way of naturalizing violence, but also racism and inequity. Can you explain what you mean by this?
Sure. Well, first of all, there is a specific genre of media we call pornography, hardcore, sexually explicit, mostly film these days. And my book looks at that particular media genre, but we should recognize that the problem of pornography is not just a specific kind of media, but the way that a pornographic vision of the world is infused in all media, including the mainstream media of pop culture, Hollywood movies, television, network and cable, all of that. And the basic kind of pornographic vision is of women as objectified bodies available for male sexual pleasure. Now, that's not original to pornography. Pornography is not the only vehicle for that ideology, but it's a powerful vehicle today. And the way in which that pornographic idea has spread is very important. Now, the dominant hierarchy, the most central hierarchy in pornography is, of course, men over women, the gender inequality. But as you point out, pornography is also a viciously racist genre. In fact, of all media genre around in North America and the Western world today, it's by far the most overtly racist. It draws on racist stereotypes. It reinforces notions of white supremacy. And these are disturbing realities. Disturbing, as you point out, perhaps more so because the culture seems unable to deal with them honestly. Partly, of course, that's because explicit sex it can be difficult to deal with in a public context. But I think more powerfully, the reason the culture doesn't know how to examine this question is not because of the sexual nature of the media, but because an honest examination of that particular media genre forces us to look at the ways that male dominance, what we might call patriarchy, and white dominance, what we can call white supremacy, are still very much woven into the fabric of how this society operates.
I'm always conscious that none of this happens by accident, that none of us are accidental beings. We are the result of social constructions, of language that, verbalizes and actualizes who we become, how we see the world, the ways in which we interpret the world. Can you speak a little bit about the relationship between this perpetuation of hierarchy, patriarchy, and racial supremacy within the media and the role that this medium plays?
Yeah. Well, first of all, in some sense, you're of course correct that we like to think of ourselves as self-made people, you know, but we're always the product of both what we're trying to become, what we will ourselves to be, and what the society allows us to be and how the society affects us. We're all socialized into a certain way of understanding the world, and that doesn't mean there's only one way of understanding the world, but we're clearly the product of more than just our individual, you know, personalities and our individual force of will. On the other hand, there's one way in which some of this is accidental, that is the way the culture constructs, let's say, conceptions of masculinity and femininity, is accidental in the sense that the individuals, let's say, making pornographic films, they're not trying to perpetuate a certain ideology. They're just trying to make a dollar. And in a sexist, patriarchal culture, when the consumer base for your product is men, the easiest way to make money is by appealing to the sexism of that male clientele. And that's kind of accidental in a sense. I mean, it's not what they're after. All they're after is profit. It's a reminder that in a capitalist profit-driven economy, all other values, you know, values of equality and dignity and humanity, are pretty much going to be eliminated in the quest for profit. So there is a kind of accidental nature, but of course it's guided by these ideas of hierarchy. The media are a primary vehicle for that socialization process. We don't want to pretend the media have too much power. After all, the idea of male supremacy or white supremacy didn't originate in contemporary mass media. I think that people sometimes get wrapped up in this question of, well, are the media a cause of these social problems, or do they merely reflect them? And the answer, of course, is yes to both. Media are both a reflection of the society as it exists, but because of the power of the storytelling through mass media, especially through film and television, the media shape and reinforce these ideas as well. So both things are true, and for people who consider themselves progressive, social activists, people involved in movements for justice, the media is not a single focus. Most of us don't obsess only about the media, but we do see the media as part of this larger struggle to create a more just society.
I agree that there is both a causal and symptomatic effect, right, in that it is reflecting the kinds of things that we're producing. I've questioned, though, the naturality that these forms of violence have taken in our society, and I still feel that it's not so innocent. You know, it's not an accidental cause in that I see the state implicated in what kinds of things they promote, what kinds of things they tell us we should not participate in. Can you talk a little bit to the state apparatus and the state instruments of particular ways of seeing or creating this kind of instrumental view of the world where, yeah, well, we're just creating capital, and so, you know, these are natural consequences?
There is no question about law, society, culture, economics, in which the state is not involved. After all, the state is the sort of primary organizing principle for contemporary politics. And so state policy, whether it's the assertion of a particular law or policy or the absence of a law or policy, is always implicated. And here again, we should be careful because it is complex. So you're, of course, correct in asserting that when the state creates the context for a capitalist economy and does not impose collective values on corporations, it is helping to create certain things. So the state is responsible in some sense for the proliferation of the hardcore misogynistic racist pornography. It has a role in it. But the state is complex. The same U.S. government, for instance, that has been implicated in this spread of misogynist media also passes the Violence Against Women Act, which funds shelters and rape crisis centers. And so there are conflicting values at work here. But then the next step is to say, well, you know, what does the Violence Against Women Act in the United States actually accomplish? It dribbles out a little bit of funding to agencies that basically deal with the consequences of patriarchy and are not really involved in trying to overturn patriarchy. So these are, you know, complex questions. We don't want to be simplistic in the way we approach them, but we also want to recognize that the core question is, are we going to remake society along principles of the inherent dignity of all people and equality? And we've made strides in North America, in the Western world in the last century toward those goals, but we still face incredible impediments. And we've been talking about three different kinds of impediments. One is the structure of the economy, which rewards people who pursue values that have nothing to do with dignity or equality. The nature of the state, which often protects, of course, that economy. And then these underlying cultural understandings of what it means to be a person that are wrapped up in male supremacy and white supremacy. Those are harder to dislodge. You can't pass a law to say people shall no longer think of men as naturally dominant to women. So we've got different levels of struggle. Quite frankly, when you put it out on the table that way, it can seem kind of overwhelming, because these forces arrayed to support hierarchy, of course, are very powerful. But I think it's very important to be clear about what we're up against, because, of course, you can't fashion a strategy to pursue a more just world without understanding what you're up against.
You know, we never really talk about the role of race and gender in determining who holds power within the structures within education. For students, for people who see education as a practice for liberation, as a place to be reflective and imagine a different culture, how do we create that culture within education without first having to address that hierarchy of inequality that already pre-exists and continues to recreate itself?
Well, this is unfortunately very complicated and sometimes quite frankly, very depressing, because let's just take the question of race and step back. In the United States, where I live, there have been enormous improvements in public policy around race in my lifetime. Remember that I was born in 1958. In 1958, the United States was an apartheid society. In most of the states, there was a second-class citizenship, both in law and in practice, for non-white people. Well, that's been eliminated, at least in law. There is equality, at least sort of on the books. And that's an incredible accomplishment. At the same time, we can see that the opportunities for non-white people who might have had a different view of how to structure society from the dominant white population, that their access to privilege and power, their ability to become a university professor or to become a politician or a business owner, is really typically dependent on their willingness to accept the hierarchical structure of society. And so Barack Obama is president of the United States, but he's president of the United States, an African-American man, by virtue of his signaling to the dominant power structure that he will not challenge that. Now, that's not to beat up on Barack Obama, it's just to observe something pretty obvious. You know, Clarence Thomas is on the U.S. Supreme Court, and he's right now probably the most right-wing reactionary member of that Supreme Court. His access to power and privilege has been accomplished in part by signaling his willingness to accept that hierarchy. So at every institution where we're trying to make changes, we're going to find that the people who have access to power and privilege are unfortunately going to often be the most compromised. But on the other hand, nothing is complete. Nothing is that simple. So I work at the University of Texas, a large state-supported research institution that's not committed to progressive values. It's committed to hierarchy. But within that university, there's all sorts of people who are attempting subversive activities, you know, trying to undermine hierarchy. And so your question, it took a long time to build up to answering your question, in part because your question doesn't, of course, have a simple answer. But we try to create spaces where we have some ability to do that, to foster critique, to foster subversion, basically. I try and do that in the classroom. Lots of people try and do it through administrative ways. It's not the end of the answer. You know, we still have to deal with these larger structures. Take education, for instance. Lots of people are trying to do creative things within the school system in the United States, the public school system. I know some of these folks. They're friends of mine who are teachers who are doing really great work. But they still, at the end of the semester, have to administer the standardized test, the hierarchical imposition of these ridiculous standardized tests to judge knowledge. And therefore, their teaching has to accommodate that. So both things are true. They're given a certain amount of freedom to challenge, and in the end, they're also subordinated to this system of ridiculous testing. And so, you know, we make inroads where we can. We both try to work in very small ways on the ground, locally where we are, and we try and keep an eye on the bigger picture. You know, this is not a revolutionary moment in history, at least not in the United States or in Canada. It doesn't look like there's going to be massive social change toward a more progressive, just, and decent society in the near future. So that doesn't mean we give up. It just means we work where it appears there is a likelihood of advancing the cause, realizing it's a long-term struggle. I know that doesn't, you know, provide a strategy necessarily, but it does, I think, provide a kind of principle that can help guide us as we try and make decisions.
Pornography not only debases women, but also debases men, as, you know, it prescribes a kind of way of being male that doesn't tell the whole story. So I think that's one of the ways that we challenge those structures is by challenging how we think and act and be within that structure. And I think that we change those spaces just as much as they change us, right? So tell me, what inspires you to envision, and how do you envision male feminists participating in the struggle against violence against women?
Well, of course, every liberation movement that exists where people who are on the bottom of a hierarchy are challenging that hierarchy, every one of those movements provides an opportunity for people with unearned privilege and power to contribute. Feminism allows space for men to do that. Critical race movements allow space for white people. So, you know, sometimes those of us with privilege, we try to justify our inaction by saying, well, there's no place for me to contribute, but of course there is. And one of the reasons that might motivate people in positions of power and privilege to do that, as you point out, is to recognize that even though these systems of hierarchy do give us certain kinds of goodies, you know, especially short-term material kind of rewards, that we lose something in the process. The main thing we lose, of course, is our own humanity. To hold on to unearned privilege and power and really believe you have a right to it is to give up some of your own humanity. Now, when we say that there's something in it for people with privilege and power to resist hierarchy, we don't want to be, you know, naive. There are powerful forces that keep people locked into support for those systems. But I think we do have to talk openly and honestly, especially those of us who have tried to make a contribution to movements, that there is a reward in it. We don't want to pretend that the only reason people act is out of selfishness, but, you know, that is part of who we are as human beings. We respond to our own self-interest. And so one way to think about this is how to redefine self-interest for people in positions of unearned privilege and power. One writer used to describe this as changing from an idea of self-interest to an idea of what is in the interest of your best self. That is, how do you aspire to be something more than you are? And I think when we look honestly at that, those of us in these positions of unearned privilege and power, the answer to that question, how do we become our best self, is by trying to, with the resources we have, contribute to movements to challenge hierarchy, authority, domination. And that's been not just a theory for me and for people I've worked with. It's been a real-life experience. I've spent about the last 20 years now actively involved in these kind of political movements. And I can tell you without question, I'm a happier, healthier human being today than I was 30 years ago when I was not thinking about these things and not politically active. So those of us who have engaged in these kind of struggles, especially, for instance, men who've tried to challenge the various forms of sexual exploitation of women in the culture, we need to be willing to speak about that. Not, you know, to say, look at me, I'm such a great guy, everybody should love me because I'm a man who's committed to feminism, but to model some sort of alternative. Because most men walk through their lives with absolutely no model of what it would be to challenge the conventional notions of masculinity. I know growing up, I certainly had no models. I didn't see anybody who was talking about feminism. I didn't see any men who were saying, listen, you can reject this toxic conception of masculinity. So I think it's incumbent on us to talk, not arrogantly, and certainly not to self-aggrandize, but just to be honest about what is possible in this world.
You contribute to a magazine called Common Dreams, and you know, I love the name because I think that although there is this, it's the differences that we are fighting for, right? To recognize that although we're not the same, and we have never been the same, we all have different barriers, that we can work towards things that we have in common, that, you know, things that make us all move towards what's in the best interest of my best selves, as you just said, which I thought was beautiful. So what ought to be, you know, our common dream for citizenry, for instance? As teachers, we are implicated in either silencing or being part of creating spaces for unheard voices to come forth. Where do you see the spaces that we need to be working towards? Many of us are denied spaces within our classrooms because our teachers are fearful. How do you overcome that fear, and what are the opportunities?
Well, first of all, to ask what are our common dreams is actually a pretty simple question if we take seriously our own moral and theological systems. You know, everybody in this world claims some sort of moral, whether it's a secular moral or a religiously inspired moral system. And the interesting thing is, for all of the differences among those moral systems, and of course there are differences, but there are some pretty core ideas that animate all these systems. And the one that's most obvious is what is sometimes called the ethic of reciprocity, the idea that you fashion a system to live in which you wouldn't impose on others things you would not want imposed on yourselves. In the Christian tradition, we call this the golden rule, do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. But there's some version of that in every system you can find. Well, if we actually took that seriously, we would certainly want to work toward a world in which people are not living in abject poverty, as about half the world's population is. We would certainly try to fashion a world in which the ability of a nation state to amass military power wouldn't be the basis for the privilege of some and the suffering of others. I mean, all of these things are pretty straightforward. We just have to take our own moral principles seriously. Now, in a world structured on hierarchy, of course, there's a lot of impediments to that, and I think the place to do that most effectively is in the smallest places where we live and work, that is, at the level of the local, the grassroots. I'm not saying there isn't an important role for national and international movements. But when you ask the question, how do we sort of start to live a different way? Well, we do that in the places where we live. That might be, you know, trying to commit to a more democratic workplace where you actually fashion rules to let people control their own work. In a church, it might be taking seriously the moral precepts of the faith and trying to make that central in the life of the church, rather than sort of sterile rituals or, you know, chanting the right doctrines or something like that. In political organizing, it means, I think, paying attention to our personal relationships as we go about the business of trying to pursue public policy, for instance. You know, creating spaces where people not only try to achieve results, you know, getting a law passed or, you know, getting a policy changed, but also treat each other with dignity and respect. You know, that's long been understood in political theory, that if you're trying to bring into existence a new world, the process by which you bring that world into existence has to model the best way we want to interact. That doesn't mean people aren't strategic and don't make compromises now and then, but at a very basic level, those of us who are white, those of us who are male, those of us who are economically privileged, and I happen to be in all three of those categories, we have to model behavior that takes seriously democracy and equality, which means we can't hold on to the power and privilege we have in those progressive spaces where we claim we're trying to make changes. We can't, you know, kind of hold out our trump card of, you know, whiteness or maleness or economic resources. We really do have to commit to something else. Now, I've been extremely fortunate to be part of activities in Austin, Texas, where I live, with women, with people of color, with immigrant workers, people on low income, where we're creating spaces to try and do that. It's not easy. It's a struggle. I find that every day I have to remind myself that I do have this privilege, and I better think about how to contribute to the group rather than just make myself feel good. It's a struggle, and some people say, well, I get tired of that struggle, but my own experience is that that struggle is what has made my own life meaningful. I do it not just because I think it's the right thing to do, but because at the end of the day, no matter how tired I am, I have a sense that I have, tried to become my best self. And that may be a rather intangible, sort of reward, but for those of us, I think, who can speak to this, the first thing we would say is it's a very real reward. And it is, in fact, I think, what motivates the people throughout history as we look back at people who have been able to maintain a commitment to this kind of radical political organizing. It has been the reward that motivated them as well.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Dr. Robert Jensen. He's the author of many books. How can people access your work?
The easiest way is just to put my name into a search engine, Robert Jensen, and the first page that comes up will be my page at the university with a lot of articles and other references people might find interesting.
Thank you again for being with us.
Always my pleasure. Thank you, Sylvia.
Take care.
Before I sign off this week, I wanted to give a shout out to the latest two stations that have decided to carry our show. The first is Lou Radio at 102.7 FM in the pristine community of Thunder Bay, Ontario. You can listen to them online at www.luradio.ca. And the second is Radio Free Moscow at 92.5 FM in the unique and vibrant community of Moscow, Idaho. You can also listen to them online at radiofreemoscow.org. And you can also find links to both stations on our website at latinwavesmedia.com. And it's an honor to be carried there. We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.